By remote, this is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. Vice President-elect Joe Biden, Vice President-elect Joe Biden, named his top officials to deal with the country's coronavirus ravaged economy, including former Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen, to be the first woman to lead the Treasury Department in its 231-year history. Biden's latest appointments underscore the incoming president's promise to create a top rung of officials that demographically looks like America, one staffed with several female appointees and people of color. Biden is preparing to take office at his inauguration as the 46th U.S. president on January the 20th. The World Health Organization says it is very worried about the rapidly growing surge of coronavirus cases in Brazil and Mexico. Mexico's cumulative COVID death rate stands at 105,000. Brazil has recorded more than 172,000 deaths from COVID-19, second only to the United States, which has reported more than 267,000 deaths. Meanwhile, drug maker Moderna said Monday it is seeking emergency authorization, that is, in the U.S. and Europe to distribute its coronavirus vaccine after tests showed it is 94% effective. The request comes shortly after another drug company, Pfizer-BioNTech, sought the same emergency authorization. If granted, inoculations in the U.S. could begin as soon as mid-December. Meantime, the WHO, urging nations to carefully consider the ski season risk, said that while the risk of catching the coronavirus is low on the slopes, crowded airports and restaurants could help spread the virus. For more news, as always, we invite you to join us at our website. That is voanews.com. Via remote, this is VOA News. Amnesty International is urging the United Nations Security Council to renew its arms embargo on South Sudan, saying violence, atrocities, and war crimes against civilians have quadrupled this year, despite a ceasefire and formation of a unity government in February. Government forces and the rebel group, the National Salvation Front, have clashed several times this year. Each time, each accuses the other of violating a ceasefire signed in Rome at the beginning of the year. Britain and the European Union are warning each other that time is running out to reach a Brexit trade deal, with big differences still to be bridged on state aid, enforcement, and fishing. Britain leaves the EU's orbit on December 31st, when the transition period of informal membership ends following its formal departure last January. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says a deal would be preferable, but it Britain will flourish without one. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo urged Ethiopia to stop the fighting as Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed commended his troops for what he termed their victory in the Tigrayan capital of Mekelle. Pompeo spoke with Ahmed on Monday, urging a complete end to the fighting in Tigray, a start to dialogue, free, safe, unhindered humanitarian access. Claims of violence and death tolls have been impossible to confirm as telecommunications and internet service have been cut in Tigray since fighting began. Abiy announced the military offensive against the regional government in Tigray on November the 4th, saying it was in response to an attack by Tigray forces on a federal military base. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg on Monday said China's rise could present, in his words, important opportunity for our economies, but pose important challenges to our security. Speaking at a press conference of a meeting of the Military Alliance foreign ministers, the NATO leader said Beijing, and again in his words, investing massively in new weapons and tries to intimidate other countries. He added China is coming closer to us from the Arctic to Africa by investing in our infrastructure and urge allies to come together on the issue. And China has provided North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and his family with an experimental coronavirus vaccine, according to a U.S. analyst citing two unidentified Japanese intelligence sources. For more news, please join us at our website, voanews.com. Via remote, this is VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbatha in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 1st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Togo's diaspora demands the unconditional release of two opposition leaders.
The only thing that can be charged against them is that they have called for a protest to take place on last Saturday, but the protest was forbidden and nobody go to that protest.
The people of Nigeria's Borno state are burying those killed by Boko Haram insurgents over the weekend. Zimbabwe's government is called upon to take decisive action as coronavirus spreads in schools. And Somalia recalls its ambassador to Kenya.
The upcoming elections in Somalia are already raising tension both domestically and across the border. The fact that it has been called a consultation gives a window of hope that diplomacy is still an option for the two countries.
And drought threatens millions in southern Madagascar. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Togolese Diaspora Coalition for Alternation and Democracy is condemning what it calls the kidnapping and arrest of two opposition leaders and demanding their release. The Togolese government said it arrested Bridget Ajamagbo Johnson and Gerald Josu over the weekend for plotting to destabilize the internal security of the state. The two had called for a demonstration over the weekend about the re-election of President Fornas Simbe in last February's election, which opposition candidate Abayomi Kojo said he won. Bridget Akuvi Amagavi is the coordinator of Togo Debut Europe Coalition.
First of all, Mr. Josu, who is in charge of social affairs and human rights, was leaving a meeting with the ambassadors in Lome. On his way back to his home, he was kidnapped. It's the real term. Madame Brigitte Ajamagbo went there at the security services to see his colleague. She was told that she couldn't see him at that moment, and she went back home. And finally, she was called, and she was told that she can now come to the same place and visit his fellow. And in fact, when she got there, she was arrested and brought back to her home, where the perquisition was carried out again, illegally, and finally she was arrested. Yesterday, there were a communication, a press conference done by the prosecutor, who declared that they have been arrested on the allegation of destabilization initiative, because some documents has been found in their home, which shows that they were preparing a coup to destabilize the country. What we know also is that the only thing that can be charged against them is that they have called for a protest, which was to take place on last Saturday. But the protest was forbidden, and nobody go to that protest. So they cannot be charged to have breached the tradition of protest.
You said, Bridget, you are calling on the de facto authorities of Togo to release Bridget Ajamagbo and the other opposition. But the government in Togo, President Fornas Simbe, said he was legally elected by the people of Togo.
We know how elections go on in Togo. We are part of an association which has been working since 2009 on electoral processes in Togo. And they all, since 2010 and even before, elections has always been fraudulent in Togo. That's the reason why there is this protest. And that the people from the coalition that headed by Brigitte Ajamagbo Johnson claiming that their candidate is the real winner, while the authorities claim they have won this election. What I can say is that the results that has been published both by the Electoral Commission and confirmed by the Constitutional Court are full of inconsistencies.
The last time we spoke to Bridget Ajamagbo Johnson was in July of this year. At that time, she was concerned about the arrest of Abayomi Kodjo, and so what do you know about the status of Abayomi Kodjo now?
I don't know exactly where he is. He declared that he's hidden somewhere because of fears for his security. But I don't know exactly if he's still in the country or if he has left. But both Abayomi Kodjo and Bridget Ajabagbo has been briefly arrested after the February elections. And they have been released after signing a commitment that they will not talk anymore about this election, and they will not protest anymore against this election, which is completely anti-democratic.
Bridget Akuvi Amigambi is the coordinator of Togo Debuti Europe Coalition. She was speaking with us from Paris, France. There were funerals Sunday in Nigeria's northern state of Borno for dozens of local rice farmers killed by Boko Haram insurgents. President Muhammadu Buhari has condemned the attack and pledged his government will bring to justice those responsible. But residents say the government is unable to protect them from terror attacks and are turning to local militias for protection. For Daybreak Africa, VOA's Chinedu Ofor spoke with Abubakar Mohamed Sani, a security affairs analyst, who says the government should do more to secure its citizens.
Attacks by Boko Haram on Nigeria, particularly in the northeastern part of Nigeria, has reduced. But the fact is that the attacks have been on and it's been there since the year 2009 up to date. And more importantly, since around February, March, by the emergence of this coronavirus, attacks by terrorist groups, particularly the Boko Haram insurgents, has drastically reduced.
What are you attributing to the reduction of these attacks? Is it the coronavirus or the government's effort in containing the insurgency and the terrorists?
Both are very correct. One, the factors that contribute to the reduction in Boko Haram attacks in Nigeria are basically government efforts. When I say government efforts, there have been military presence in the northeast fighting Boko Haram. And beyond that, there have been change of tactics, there have been change of ground troops commanders. The troops have been overhauled over time in order to renew their strength, in order to make them perform better. But of course, Boko Haram tactics have been that of the asymmetric tactics. So they don't fight frontally, and they are not even facing the troops, that is the Nigerian army or military, they are fighting. So they fight clandestinely, and at the fight, they appear to disappear and reappear. In other words, what I'm trying to say is that military presence, change of tactics, and maybe more of weapons procured under the present government. The factor that has contributed more to the reduction of Boko Haram attacks in Nigeria had been likely of this COVID-19 emergency.
All these factors put together, has that improved security in the northern part of Nigeria?
The truth, sincerely, is that some of the towns, villages, areas occupied by the Boko Haram insurgents have been taken over by the federal government again, which had driven them back into their enclaves or back into the Sambisa forest.
With Boko Haram and insurgency and also just banditry, what do you think this Christmas will be like in terms of security?
Well, hopefully in terms of security, we hope as Nigerians that the Nigerian state as a whole will become a very paramount thing to the government. And we hope that the Christmas and the festive period will be a safer period for all Nigerians as people move from one location to other locations to celebrate the Christmas and the New Year mood with some of their family, friends, relatives, colleagues, and so many other things.
That was security affairs analyst Abubakar Mohamed Sani. He spoke with VOA's Chinedu Ofor from Maiduguri, Nigeria. Somalia has recalled its ambassador to Kenya and ordered Kenya's envoy to leave Mogadishu over alleged interference in its coming elections. Somali officials accused Kenya of putting pressure on Jubaland region's leaders to break an agreement for indirect elections instead of a popular vote. Mohammed Yusuf spoke with analysts on what's behind the diplomatic spat from Nairobi and has this report.
Somalia's government accuses its neighbor Kenya of continuous interference in its internal affairs. The accusations come a day after the Jubaland region leader Ahmed Mohamed, also known as Madobe, threatened to boycott the parliament vote scheduled for December. Somalia's Foreign Ministry Permanent Secretary Mohamed Ali Nour said Kenya has influenced Madobe's decision.
And Federalka, Somalia.
It has become clear for the Somali federal government that the Kenyan government is openly interfering with the Somali affairs, he says, and pressuring the Jubaland president Ahmed Mohamed Islam to influence its interests and retract on the election model agreed on September 17th by the Somali government and regional leaders, he says. On Saturday, Madobe said extra security forces must be deployed to his area before he can go ahead with the election. Kigen Murumbasi teaches international relations and security at the Strathmore University in Kenya. He believes Somalia and Kenya will get past this diplomatic dispute.
We see now where the upcoming elections in Somalia are already raising tension, both domestically and across the border. And when we look at normally the relations among states, there are cases where, you know, the interests of states sometimes clash with each other. And to deal with such a situation, diplomacy now has to play its own role. Now, the fact that it has been called a consultation, that you go back for consultation, leaves a window of hope that diplomacy is still an option for the two countries.
In February 2019, Kenya also recalled its ambassador and sent a Somali envoy back home for consultations over the auctioning of oil exploration blocks. After a few weeks, the situation went back to normal between the two countries. Boaz Mbaya comments on foreign policy and diplomatic issues in East Africa. He says Somalia wants to be seen strong as it heads to elections.
Somalia is beginning to look inward. It is because there are elections coming, perhaps, and therefore the authorities there would want to be seen as being strong. So I guess that is probably an explanation that what can advance. But I don't see the fallout in terms of leading to war between Kenya and Somalia.
In a press statement Monday, the Kenyan Ministry of Foreign Affairs said it has not received an official requesting its envoy in Somalia to return home. The statement further reads, Kenya respects the sovereignty, political independence, and territorial integrity of all countries. Kenya and Somalia have an ongoing court case at the International Court of Justice over a maritime border dispute. Somalia has been reluctant to negotiate with Kenya about the disputed territory. Mbaya says the two countries need to talk over the issue that are dividing them.
Kenya and Somalia are members of IGAD, they're members of the AU, they're members of the United Nations. So we need a diplomatic solution to the problem. So there are no shortcuts, and I think it's just a matter of engaging the right person at the right time. And then with the right atmosphere, it should be possible.
Kenya is one of several African countries that has deployed troops in Somalia to fight militant group Al-Shabaab and support the Somali government. But its presence in the country makes many Somali officials uneasy. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 1st. Let's send shout-outs to listeners on these our VOA affiliate stations, Radio Banga, FM 96.5 in Bong County, Central Liberia, Radio Life in Lofa County, Liberia, Buffalo FM in Monrovia, Liberia, Brela FM in Nigeria, Kisi FM in Tanzania, Capital FM in Blantyre, Malawi, and Kira FM in Jinja, Uganda. There are increasing calls for Zimbabwe's government to take decisive action following the spread of coronavirus at more schools after an initial outbreak at a boarding school. But with national examinations starting this week, the government says schools should remain open. Kuzaina Musenge has details.
The Ministry of Primary and Secondary Education has reported that more than 300 pupils had tested positive for COVID-19 as more schools across the country recorded infections. A boarding school on the outskirts of Zimbabwe's second biggest city, Bulawayo, was the first to record cases nearly 2 weeks ago. The infection in schools have heightened fears that they are becoming the new epicenter of the disease. Communications Director Taunga Nandoro of the Primary and Secondary Education Ministry says there is no need to worry as the government is doing everything it can to contain the spread of the infections in schools. He said only a few schools out of the over 9,600 the ministry runs had recorded cases. Ndoro said the national examinations scheduled to start this week will go ahead and infected pupils will be allowed to write their exams in isolation. But Obet Masaraure, president of the Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe, says his organization has been vindicated. It has always argued that the government was premature in reopening schools because it had not put in place adequate measures to safeguard students and teachers.
As we predicted as the trade unions, schools were not ready to accommodate the large volumes of learners without addressing the fundamentals like adequate infrastructure for safe social distancing, running water, among other necessities. As Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe, we are running an evaluation process where we are using the standard operating procedures that were set by the Ministry of Primary and Secondary Education, and we are evaluating schools against this standard. Most of our schools are performing badly. They're scoring way below 25%, and which obviously render them in the red zone with regard to COVID-19 infections.
Former Health Minister and physician Dr. Henry Madzorera said it is best for the government to revise its decision to reopen schools.
The teachers had warned against opening schools early. They told us that they didn't have adequate PPE, adequate materials to use for the prevention of the spread of COVID-19. But we ignored that advice. Public health specialists warned us that opening schools prematurely lead to problems. And now schools have opened at a time when we know there is an upsurge in COVID-19 cases. And this is the result. The advice we give to government is still the same. We don't have to open our schools because neighboring countries have opened their schools. Let's make independent decisions that look at our circumstances and the problems that we as a nation have in the healthcare sector and do the right thing.
Shepherd Mrawi is the National Coordinator of Education Coalition of Zimbabwe, a civic organization that advocates for education. He says his organization is saddened by the COVID-19 cases in schools and says the group had insisted that the government ensure that schools were safe.
We therefore encourage schools to periodically test their students and teachers, and we also encourage teachers and students to minimize movement and call for our government through its relevant ministries to capacitate schools by ensuring that all the schools in Zimbabwe have enough PPEs and at least a COVID-19 response trained officer will ensure an adherence and response to any emergencies that may be unforeseen that they can be in a position to attend to.
Zimbabwe has experienced relatively low infection figures compared with other countries, and the government decided to reopen schools in phases starting at the end of September with examination classes returning to school first. The final of the three phases was in early November when the rest of the classes resumed lessons. Reporting for VOA from Bulawayo, I am Kudzanai Msengi.
The United Nations World Food Program, the WFP, says southern Madagascar is in the grip of a humanitarian catastrophe, with 1.5 million people, half the region's population, needing immediate emergency food assistance. The agency says three straight years of drought have wiped out harvest and hampered people's access to food, and that COVID-19 is compounding the suffering. Shasa Magrabi, WFP spokesperson in New York, says the situation requires an urgent response.
So the situation is extremely concerning. You've got around half the region's population, that's 1.5 million people, are experiencing what we call crisis or emergency levels of hunger. These numbers are actually three times what was predicted in the middle of this year, because the situation just worsened rapidly across 10 districts. The reasons behind this is a combination of the drought, but also COVID-19, the pandemic, and growing insecurity. And all these are compounding an already severe food insecurity situation in southern Madagascar. Most of the people suffering from hunger are women and children, and they need immediate food and nutrition assistance. We are planning to assist 891,000 people through to June 2021, and hopefully we can scale up. But in order to do so, we need urgent funds. But just to give you a context, even before COVID-19, Madagascar was a low-income country. You've got 80% of its million people living on less than $1.9 per day. And it has the world's 10th highest stunting rate. Half of the children under five suffer from chronic malnutrition. So the situation was already bad, and it's been compounded by COVID-19, drought, and other factors.
How long do you think this has been going on?
As I mentioned, the situation was always a severe food insecurity situation there. But since 2016, an estimated 1.6 million people in the southern part of the island have been classified as food insecure. You know, years of droughts and climate shocks have had a massive impact on people, especially living in the southern areas of Madagascar. You've got 5 million people living in areas that are prone to natural disasters and climate shocks, and that all intensifies the vulnerability to food insecurity and malnutrition.
How is the WFP assisting the people of southern Madagascar?
So we are trying to intervene in multiple ways. The short term, we are providing life-saving emergency food assistance. Starting from the end of September, we have reached more than 100,000 people through food distributions, with a particular focus on children and the elderly. We're providing hot meals to those people. We're also providing assistance to more than 500,000 people in drought-stricken southern districts through December to assist with the lean season. Of course, you know, as I mentioned before, like if we need to scale up, we will continue and monitor the situation to see how many more people we need to reach and support. On the longer term, we are working with the government to improve smallholder farmers' livelihoods and resilience to climate shocks so that they're able to cope and have the skills and ability to access and use the climate information and the financial services and markets at hand to help build their resilience against climate shocks. What we really need right now is funds, obviously, to carry out this operation and avert the implications of this crisis. And so far, our funding shortfall for the next 6 months is $37.5 million. It's very important and essential that we have those funds so that we could at least mitigate the impact of this crisis on its people. The situation is really grave. We are seeing mothers unable to breastfeed their children, families resorting to severe coping mechanisms, such as taking their children out of school so the children can work and, you know, help secure some food for the family. People resorting to eating insects and cactuses to survive. So it's a very worrisome situation, and we really need to support the people as urgently as we can.
Thank you so much, Shaza, for making the time to speak with us. We do appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much.
That was Shaza Magrabi, the World Food Program spokesperson in New York. And that's it for this Tuesday, December 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, hoping that you will have a great week.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African Beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to Ndumbulu and Makossa to Kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.